and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, agricultural ecologist, ethnobotanist, and writer Gary Paul Nabhan. He gave the keynote address at this year's Alaska Botanical Garden Annual Spring Conference. Gary's talk, entitled "Traditional Foods at Risk in Salmon Nation, Threatened Wild and Cultivated Plants," was recorded at the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage on March 8th.
I'm extremely thrilled to introduce to you tonight our keynote speaker for the Spring Garden Conference, Gary Paul Nabhan. He's an internationally celebrated nature writer, food and farming activist, and a proponent of conserving the links between biodiversity and cultural diversity. He's been honored as a pioneer and creative force in the local foods movement and seed-saving community by Utney Reader, Mother Earth News, New York Times, Bioneers, and Time Magazine. As the W.K. Kellogg Endowed Chair in Sustainable Food Systems at the University of Arizona Southwest Center, he works to build a more just, nutritious, sustainable, and climate-resilient food shed. He was among the earliest researchers to promote the use of native foods in preventing diabetes, especially in his role as co-founder and researcher with the Native Seeds Search. Gary is also personally engaged as an orchard keeper, a wild foods forager and pollinator, habitat restorationist, working from his small farm in Patagonia, Arizona. He has helped forge the Radical Center for Collaborative Conservation among farmers, ranchers, indigenous peoples, and environmentalists in the West. He's played key roles in establishing the Ironwood Forest National Monument, community-based seed banks, land reserves for conserving wild crop relatives, and restored habitats for migratory pollinators in the West. Agricultural historian Peter Hatch of Monticello has called Nabhan the lyrical scholar of genetic diversity for his creative writing and its influence on community-based conservation. He has been honored with a MacArthur Genius Award, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, a Southwest Book Award, and John Burroughs Medal for Nature Writing, the Vavilov Medal, and several honorary degrees and lifetime achievement awards. Gary works most of the year as a research scientist at Tumamuk Hill and the Southwest Center of the University of Arizona, and is engaged with several food justice and farming alliances, including Sabores Sin Fronteras, the Wild Farm Alliance, and Renewing America's Food Traditions. He is humbled and honored to serve as a professed ecumenical Franciscan brother, helping the Franciscan Action Network in shaping ethical responses to environmental injustice, to immigration issues, and to climate change. We're thrilled to introduce to you tonight Gary Paul Nabhan. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. And I just thought that thing that Jeff did with the auction was amazing. That was instant gratification for all of you, I noticed. But he must be the fastest auctioneer in the West. I mean, that was unbelievable. So I hope everyone goes home with some great treats. I have to say it's a delight to be up here. I only get up to Alaska every 3 or 4 years. I'm always kind of go through this week of low self-esteem. This is, you know, we're an A state, but you're a big A state. We're a small A state. And I was kind of whining and feeling, you know, insecure about coming up to such a big state from our little A state. When a friend said, well, you know, if we just flattened out the whole Grand Canyon and then spread it out, we'd almost be as big as Alaska. So I don't know if that counts or not, but I'm really grateful to be here. I also want to say that I'm very grateful to Julianne and the staff and board and their wonderful colleagues in the community who've been hosting me. I've just had a delightful time since since I arrived here in Iditarod, capital of the universe. So I'm going to talk tonight. They told me to hold off on talking to you all, lecturing all of you about the birds and the beasts until I got to know you a little bit more. So I'll do that tomorrow, okay, with the pollinator stuff. But today I'm going to talk about a project that I've been engaged in with a whole bunch of organizations, as you can see from that photo and the list there, that have been involved in a collaborative called Renewing America's Food Traditions, which is trying to work with the most endangered wild and cultivated food plants and animals on the continent. It seems ironic that we have endangered lists of just about everything in the world, from you know, whales to Elvis Presley records to whatever. And the food plants that we rely upon every day, many of them are also endangered. And oddly, we don't spend as much time on conserving the things of most direct use to us and to our nutritional health. So we started a project in about 10 years ago with Slow Food, American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, Seed Savers Exchange, Native Seed Search, and some of the organizations you saw up there. Again, I'm especially grateful to the Native American First Nations elders who advised us, mentored us on how to deal with some of the issues with the plants that they have long traditions of using as food. So I'm particularly honored by those connections. But in general, what we've done is gone region to region and developed work groups of scientists, farmers, chefs, food historians, horticulturalists, to try to bring back to the table, sometimes for the first time in 50 or 100 years, food crops that played essential roles in the traditions on this continent for millennia. And so I'll be talking about that. So basically, we have an umbrella term for these plants and animals that we call place-based heritage foods. But what do we mean by that? We mean wild and cultivated seeds and breeds, forageable wild plants or herbs, fish, game, fowl, that fit into particular habitats in particular ecoregions and have strong links to particular cultural communities. They're a lot like what botanists or zoologists would call endemic species that are adapted to the particular conditions of an environment. And why these are often endangered has to do with the fact that we've made one place like every other on this continent by the kind of development that we've had over the last two centuries. We've homogenized the landscape, and when we plant the same variety of corn from one side of the continent to the next, or plant the same kind of mint in our herb gardens from one region to the next, that homogenization means that we often neglect to notice that some rarer, more specialized, geographically restricted species or varieties are falling through the cracks. And these are some examples of some traditions. Now, we're not talking just about the plants, but the traditions associated with them being at risk. I have raised Navajo Churro sheep, the oldest sheep variety that was introduced to North America by the Spanish in about 1640. And helped the Navajo Churro Sheep Association to its 25th anniversary. We had sheep boy music instead of cowboy music for the event. It was perhaps the first sheep boy concert ever in public. A lot of people sing to their sheep, but we won't tell you what they sing. The Churro sheep are really finely adapted to the desert conditions of the Southwest. Of course, some of the herring fishing tradition, not so much the big boats that we see coming up to Sitka, but the herring roe on spruce boughs or on kelp are the kinds of specific traditions that occur in one particular area that even though kelp may be other places and herring might be in other places, that peculiar combination of things is what we would say is one of these place-based traditions. And then, of course, we have place-based vegetable or fruit varieties, what we call heirloom vegetables. And one example that we give in the book, Renewing America's Food Traditions, is a McFadden or giant cabbage that was historically part of that crazy cabbage contest you have, that's sort of the Iditarod of cabbage growing, I guess. So these are some examples of what we're talking about. A good example of some place-based foods of Salmon Nation, this ecoregion that we're talking about here, might be these unique potato varieties of the Haida, Tlingit, Makah, Kasan, and other peoples of the coastal areas that we believe came up from South America to Mexico historically, perhaps with the Spanish, and they got at least as far as the Monterey Bay area in California. And then whether they were brought further by the Spanish themselves or sort of hopped northward through trade among native nations, we don't know. Geneticists and historians are still trying to figure it out. But the remarkable thing is that they're the only potatoes that didn't go to Europe before they came back to North America. Most of what we eat in fast food restaurants and that we get from grocery stores are these potatoes that went directly from South America to Europe and then came back to North America. So the Macao Zet potato is one of the ones that first achieved some attention, and Merrill Johnson and other people probably in this room have been involved in community projects to bring these other potatoes back. And I was honored to meet members of the Marx family of the Tlingit community near Sitka who have been involved with this Maria's potato that Nora Marx Dauenhauer and her family kindly made available for some of the community projects. So these are examples, whether they're native or historically introduced, of some very, very unique plants, whether they're wild or cultivated. And I think we can say that what interests us about them is that they're already fit to a particular environment or have adapted to that environment, in this case over several hundred years, so that we don't have to remake the environment to fit the crop, as is so often happens in the lower 48. We've really restructured whole landscapes so they can grow particular crops like corn or artichokes or certainly all the winter vegetables that we get throughout the U.S. from greenhouses in Mexico are an example of really completely changing the environment to grow certain crops that are in demand. This is the opposite approach, to find something that's well adapted to an environment and bring that into celebration at the place into which it's adapted. The other thing about these plants is that they remind us of those deep and soulful connections between people and plants that they love. These are plants that are often embedded in a particular culture, stories, songs, cultural expressions, arts, and feasts. I even know people who name their children after their favorite plants or have particular rituals that they do in the garden or out while wild gathering. And so I think this is one example of, I think, something that many of you feel in your hearts, that plants aren't static, inert entities, but something that we communicate with, that we express our affection for, and that somehow become mentors or teachers for us. Now, contrast that kind of place-based food tradition with the commoditized crops that are now being hit by what I call the perfect storm of food insecurity, which is disrupting our food security both in the USA and from the many other places that we extract our food from outsourced areas. And I was just visiting some farms in Mexico where, again, 60% of the winter produce from November to May eaten in the United States comes from these farms. Why? Because we're paying the labor there 1/10 of what we pay farm laborers in the United States. We've scared off most of the Mexican-born farm laborers in the United States, whether legal or illegal. So this year we had $9 billion of crops left unpicked on U.S. soil because of laborers being scared by our immigration policy and moving back to Mexico or hiding out. On top of that kind of social issue that's disrupting our food security, we have environmental issues. That 2/3 of the U.S. Crop yields and livestock were damaged by drought or by floods or hurricanes in 2011, 2012. 2011 was the year that broke all records for the number of counties declared disaster areas. 500 counties declared disaster areas, largely due to the droughts in Texas and Oklahoma and New Mexico and adjacent states. Last year, it was over 2,000 counties, four times as many were hit by drought and had to be declared disaster areas. So we're entering that thing that the climatologists call the new normal. That's entirely different growing conditions in most of the continent than what we've ever had. And there's soil loss produced when we do that. People were harvesting the whole plant to produce ethanol and leaving nothing to put back into the soil. Even the use of grains and corns for ethanol is creating problems because we're not having enough of that land produce feed for livestock. In the face of drought in our area, hay prices have quadrupled in the last 16 months. So there's a hay shortage, a corn silage shortage, because all of that's going into ethanol production. And for the first time in history, states like Iowa imported corn because they have over 50 ethanol plants that need to be fed instead of people. So at the same time, this radical restructuring of agriculture means that we're seeing increased soil erosion and also increased conversion of farmland to urban development or industrial development. We're still losing 2 acres of farmland every minute in the United States. Well, that food insecurity crisis is part of, and an untold part, of the energy crisis and an economic crisis that we're facing and we will be facing for the rest of our lives. More Americans are on food stamps and using food banks than ever before. Since the 2009 economic downturn, a larger number of people are relying on food relief than relied on it during the Dust Bowl and the Depression. This is not just in the United States. Over 32 countries have had food riots the last 3 years, and it was associated with the downfall of governments because the prices for food had gotten so high that poor people, especially farm workers, couldn't pay for that food. So we now see that farm workers in the U.S. and in other countries are the people most likely to be asking for food relief, even though they're the ones that give us our daily bread. Okay? A real irony there. And that's also related to the rising cost of producing anything in the United States because we use so much fossil fuel and fossil groundwater that now as much as 46% of our ecological footprint is our food print. The energy that it takes to grow, transport, water in trucks going across the country or up the coast in boats or barges up to here, and then to sell that. 50% of that food produced is then wasted, so it never reaches our mouths. And think of the energy cost embedded in that wasted food. And we could go on and on. And I would say because of that disruption of the modus operandi, the business as usual of the way agribusiness has worked the last 50 years, these place-based heritage foods matter more than ever before. If we don't have them around, by default, we will suffer from the hidden costs of this placeless food that has come to dominate American society. And I won't go through all of this except to the points on the right, that we now have 2,500 of these place-based foods, food varieties at risk in the U.S. and Canada, 4,000 wild species potentially at risk from climate change, and we know that the energy costs of and other costs associated with a Sunday meal made up entirely of locally produced foods versus one that's imported ingredients. The imported ingredients cost or generate 650 times the amount of CO2 as the local meal. So, fellow eaters, we're at a critical point in American food history. Whether we wake up and say that to ourselves or not, we're at the pivot point. We can decide whether the way we eat each day, the way we vote with our pocketbooks in our bellies, supports a kind of food system that honors diversity and works to restore diversity to our food system, or we can continue on the path where the way we eat depletes the diversity of this continent. And we have to recognize that we're not starting with a level playing ground with all the things that were on this continent when Europeans got here 400 or 500 years ago, that many, many plants and animals historically used for food by our ancestors have now been lost from our landscapes. And that whatever we do, we will never again rely on as much fossil fuel and fossil groundwater, particularly in the lower 48, as we've used to produce food in the last 50 years. So over the last 100 years, we've depleted most of the groundwater on the continent and most of the fossil fuel that is available in reserves in the lower 48. And our choices are really to seek further and further for that, or use the biological wisdom of diverse seeds, herbs, breeds, and microbes, the ecological wisdom that we see in mixed breed herds, permaculture, intercrops, polyface pastures, and the cultural wisdom in time-tried local knowledge systems that are infused with scaled, appropriate ways of doing things. So we know we need more diversity in our food systems, but that is unlikely to be achieved on a local scale if our rural communities don't hang on to their unique seeds, breeds, roots, and shoots. And a number of us have been teaching and participating in seed schools across the country the last few years, trying to train more people to do not just big seed banks like the Millennium Seed Bank, which I very much value. I'm so excited that the Botanical Garden is involved in that. But very simple things like in Tucson now, 17 branches of our county and city library system offer the Native Seed Search seed packets in the library catalog. So whether you go online or you come to the library, you can order those seeds for free, like you have a book with your library card. And all you have to do, as promised, is to give back some of your harvest at the end of the season to regenerate that seed so that other people can try it. So there's these seed libraries happening all across the country. There's wonderful other parallels to that happening with grafting parties and cyanwood exchanges and all of that kind of thing. And a lot of this is building toward this national grassroots effort that we call Renewing America's Food Traditions, that's attempting to relocalize or at least re-regionalize and diversify our gardens, farms, and food sheds at every scale by every means possible. And it's a kind of thing I love to be involved in personally, because collaborating with people of all walks of life, all ethnicities, blue collars, white collar, green collar people, men and women, working together to get something done on a scale that's unprecedented in North American history, part of what Paul Hawkins calls the blessed unrest that now on this continent we have more people involved in social and sustainable agriculture and environmental justice, grassroots efforts than ever before in human history. And so this is an eater-based conservation strategy. My friend Poppy Tooker in New Orleans says that her grandmother once said, when she said, Grandma, you didn't make that sweet potato pie for us this week. Why didn't you do that? And she said, well, because none of you ate it last week. And Poppy, honey, if you want to eat it, you got to save it. You got to save the varieties, and you got to do that by showing that you want to eat them, or they will fall out of our fields and gardens. No one will grow them for us. No one will cook them for us. So this is trying to recreate a demand for these neglected foods, wild and cultivated, but asking this time around that we really ensure that their harvesting or their production is sustainable, that we're not over-harvesting something from the wild like has happened with ramps of little wild onions on the East Coast the last few years because the demand was so great, that we ensure that they're wild harvested in a sustainable way, and that if we're growing them, we grow them in a sustainable way. The good news is that now the sustainable food groups are the fastest growing sector of civil society in the United States. The last 4 or 5 years, we've had the largest food and farming events in American history, 120,000 people convening, 140,000, 160,000 convening for a weekend at the Common Ground Fair of the Maine Organic Farmers and Growers Association in Maine, or the Slow Food Nation meeting in San Francisco, or the Heirloom Seed Expo that's happened the last few years in Marin County. Enormous, enormous energy, and many of the speakers who've spoken at these conferences over the last few years have also been on the venues at these meetings. So it's really generating an enormous wildfire of enthusiasm among young people especially. And many of them are taking on these 2,500 lost food varieties. Already that network has grown to about 2,000 innovative farmers, foragers, and gardeners who've made special relationships with chefs, food service, cafeteria cooks in schools and museums and botanical gardens to return these foods to the plates again. And it's from people from all walks of life and all ethnicities forging partnerships to get this work done.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with agricultural ecologist, ethnobotanist, and writer Gary Paul Nabhan. His talk on traditional foods at risk in Salmon Nation was recorded on March 8th at this year's Alaska Botanical Garden Annual Spring Conference.
In fall 2006, the very first regional project that we tried to shape was here in the Salmon Nation, or Salmon Food Shed. We brought 35 farmers, fishers, chefs, folklorists, food historians together in Portland at the Eco Trust building to talk about what foods, from fish to fowl to wild herbs to fruit trees, were historically important in this region, and which of those had become vulnerable to social, environmental, or climate changes. In 2007, we released a book at the International Association of Culinary Professionals with many of the people who help write it. Most of you have probably heard of Nancy Turner, the extraordinary botanist in British Columbia. She and Sinclair Phillips, the head of Slow Food Canada, really ensured that this was a collaborative, multicultural, binational effort. And we had about 300 food journalists and chefs at the launch of this book. And it featured 180 foods that are unique to this region, and more than half of those are endangered, threatened, or extinct that we need to really bring back in some way or the other. Since then, we've done workshops in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, Calgary, Sitka, to really try to re-engage local organizations like this one in sort of taking on and adopting one or more of these crops or wild species, just like the parallel project that Julianne mentioned with the orchids, the 30 orchid species in Alaska. And so with this, each ecoregion or cultural region on the North American continent has been sort of playfully nicknamed for an iconic species, Bison Nation or Cornbread Nation. There's a great song by Tim O'Brien, Cornbread Nation. And actually, we've tried to get the Smithsonian to put out a collection of songs from every one of these food ecoregions. Hasn't quite worked yet, but maybe we can get it on YouTube that way. The point is that these are ecological and cultural keystones of those larger landscapes. Bison not only provided food directly to people, but they made buffalo wallows that then allowed the growth and stimulated the production of dozens of herbs and wildflowers and root crops, prairie turnips and things like that, prairie groundnuts. So it wasn't just bison alone that benefited from that regional management for food in the region, but many other plants went with it. So each of these has a keystone species that we kind of rally around. We're still trying to do something for Cuba where we'll either call it Rum Nation or Cigar Nation, but the other ones we kind of have fixed out. So one of the curious things that you can all help us with is determining which of these this region's foods may be at risk to biological endangerment or to cultural loss. And those things have some curious interactions. My former student, Kanan Routson, who's with that Malus fusca or Pacific crab apple tree that grows from Alaska down into Northern California,